Welcome to the Psych Podcast, the podcast where we discuss all things intro psych. I am joined by my friend, my colleague, Paul Bloom. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing well. How are you, David?
I'm doing very well. And how I'm doing seems like an apt question to discuss what we're discussing today, which is all things that impel us, that motivate us, that move us.
Yeah, that's nicely put. There's a distinction that psychologists talk about, and I think some of them hate this language, but it's between cold cognition and hot cognition. And a lot of the book that we've been talking about involving development and language and perception and memory, sort of cold computational stuff. This is now getting us into the hot stuff. This is desires, wants, needs, motivations. It's hunger and sex and a desire to do good in the world. It's what impels us.
That distinction between cold and hot is one that's it's hard not to rely on. I came up in a time where it was very popular to say, well, the division between emotion and reason is not what people think it is. These things are intertwined. And that's clearly true. But I don't know how else to say it other than that slow reasoning, deliberative, thoughtful process that we discussed in an earlier episode. You don't need that in order to be motivated by hunger, thirst, sexual desire, many, many emotions.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of fuzzy cases, a lot of things where we can't really answer, is that hot or is that cold? A lot of cases where these two blend together. So people who are worried about the distinction are worrying for a reason. But on the other hand, there's some. If you look at the extremes, you see some very real differences. A lot of the sort of hot states we're talking about, what impels us, are universally show for all sorts of creatures. You know, humans are certainly not the only creature that has sexual desire or hunger or experiences emotions like fear or rage. While some of the sort of more rational computational parts, they do show up in other creatures, but some of them may well be unique to humans, like language and certain forms of rationality. So that's one difference. And then the second difference is maybe related to the first, the computational metaphor, thinking in terms of computations and algorithms and heuristics, works well for something like remembering something or putting together a sentence. It works less well for losing your temper at somebody or falling head over heels in love.
Right. And there's something that feels more biological. Obviously, thinking is biological, but there's something more bodily about these other states.
That's right. When people argue about consciousness and whether or not machines could be conscious, the objections don't tend to be, people don't often tend to say, well, machines can't really add and subtract. They can't really do logic. Some people might say that, but that's not the more persuasive thing. But what I find fairly persuasive is whether a sort of computational mechanism can feel these emotions like falling in love or losing your temper or even wanting anything in a real sense of want. And maybe they can, but maybe these are the things, for instance, you need a body for.
Yeah. So let's start, I guess, with the most basic of these.
When we discuss motivations, people divide scientists into lumpers and splitters. And lumpers tend to say, well, it's just one thing deep down, or basically maybe two. And splitters tend to say, no, there's 10, there's 100, there's 1,000. In the chapter, I'm really more of a splitter. I think that, for instance, I really complain about people who say, well, there's just one motivation, really, to get pleasure or to avoid pain. And I think that that's hopeless as a way of explaining motivations, in a sense that it's literally not true. We do all sorts of things that don't give us pleasure or pain and avoid pain in any real sense. And then when you take it metaphorically, sometimes people say, well, whatever you do, it counts as pleasure. Then it loses any meaning. And this was actually something which I got really informed talking to you about William James. I like more of a Jamesian approach where he says, we got a lot of different motivations. Sometimes you call them instincts. We got hunger, and that's really separate from the desire for sex, which is separate from the desire to be thought of well, which is separate from the desire that those you love do well in life, which is separate from disgust, which wards you away. That's an avoidance thing, wards you away from things that could damage you in various ways.
Yeah, and they're separate not just in, say, the sense that they have different objects, they have maybe different feelings, like subjective feelings to them. They have different functions and they probably have different evolutionary roots, different biological causes. And there is a way in which it doesn't make sense to try to come up with a grand unified theory of motivation unless what you're trying to do is abstract away those differences in order to talk about something at a different level. So if you're a utilitarian philosopher and you want to maximize pleasure because you believe that that is the thing that ought to be maximized, then sure, lump together the joy I get from eating a really good dessert with the joy I get from hanging out with good friends. And if that, there's nothing wrong with abstraction at that level. It can even be true to say that all of those things share this thing in common that we're calling pleasure. But if we're psychologists and we want to understand how these different things work, how the mind is built, then it makes sense to try to separate these.
That's exactly right. And even at a level of philosophy, a lot of the people who argue against utilitarianism argue against it for exactly that point. They say you can't really treat these things on a par, not even at an abstract level. They're not fungible. So utilitarians make these claims, and I think we're both tempted by utilitarianism, so this is like a friendly critique. But suppose you imagine somebody being tortured to death in the most horrible way. And then suppose you imagine a very, very mild headache. So utilitarian says they're just, one's just more extreme than the other. And so it so follows that a whole bunch of people, each having a very mild headache, will soon add up to more than being tortured to death. And if you had to make the choice, you would rather torture a person to death than give the mild headache to, say, a billion people.
Or to give a mild headache to the same person over and over again. Like, would you rather experience mild headaches maybe one day out of the week for your whole life? Or would you rather be, like, tortured nonstop for 72 hours?
And a lot of people aren't philosophers find these questions really, really odd. Yeah. But definitely from a psychological point of view. Now, we should be honest. We both know some people in our field who are very critical of what we're going to talk about, which is they tend to think that the idea of these emotions being clearly partitioned with different parts of the brain and different evolutionary histories and different functions has had a lot of challenges. Some would argue they aren't as universal as you see. But I got to say, and I try hard in this book to be sympathetic to different perspectives, I find for at least some emotions, the argument for their specialness and the fact that they're crafted for different purposes is extremely strong. You take the emotion of fear and emotion of lust, and it's entirely clear they have different effects in the brain, if you want to scan somebody's brain, certainly in the body, and they do different things. Every aspect of fear, including the phenomenology of an experience of being afraid, is designed to say, there's a threat. I got to attend to this. I got to run away. I got to face this threat. While lust is something like, there's something really positive going on and I want to pursue it. Lust is approach. Fear is avoid.
No, I absolutely agree. And this is a challenging thing to talk about because there's so much disagreement in these camps. But I do find that a lot of the disagreement ends up being one of emphasis.
Yeah.
You know, in your examples of disgust, for instance, there is a part of disgust that is universal. It seems to be present in people from all sorts of cultures across time. And then there is a substantial part of it that is completely determined by our upbringing. And so, as you say in your book, if you are presented with food from a place that you've never visited, you didn't grow up in, you're often very, very disgusted. So the things that disgust you are going to often be determined by learning, by culture. But that doesn't seem like a right theory to me to say that disgust itself as an emotion was completely constructed by our culture.
That's right. Freud gave, you know, a lot of good things to say about Freud, but Freud gave his typically outlandish theory where he argued that disgust was inculcated into the child through toilet training. And, you know, it's not a crazy view. You could imagine how it would work. You'd even imagine a sort of weird marriage between Freud and a behaviorist who said that, you know, the kid is made through punishment at his messes to become somehow have a negative reaction to human waste, which is a disgust elicitor. But if you think about it for just a minute, there's no way that theory could work. For one thing, we're disgusted by a lot of things like blood or rotten meat, which don't have much to do with toilet training. For another thing, there are many societies that don't really have toilet training in the same sense that Freud and his milieu did, yet people everywhere are disgusted.
And that's a good example to make another point, that when you say, for instance, blood and feces and rotten meat seem to be universal elicitors of disgust, you're also not saying that you can't unlearn those things.
That's right.
Obviously, if you have to, for instance, clean up feces for a living, after a while, you're not going to be that disgusted by it. This is a point that many people have made. What is biological and universal does not mean uncontrollable and set in stone.
I think it's a deep point in a couple of ways. It's very interesting to look at the sort of things that could help us cope with disgust. One is sexual arousal. And there's been laboratory studies finding, perhaps not surprising, that sexual arousal diminishes disgust. Another one, I think, is love. When I had to do diaper changes of my young sons, before that, I thought, oh my God, what could be worse? But it wasn't that bad. But I wouldn't do it to a stranger's child if I didn't have to.
No, that really is disgusting.
That really is disgusting. Other people are really disgusting.
Anybody who has had to potty train a child does wish that in fact disgust emerged earlier in life than it actually seemed.
Yes, but imagine what a curse it would be from an evolutionary point of view for like a 1-year-old to be squirming in disgust, like so grossed out.
I've been sitting in my diaper for an hour. You monsters!
This is the worst, and they're constantly wailing. I mean, there's also a deeper sense in which it's malleable, which is disgust is typically negative. And so we veer away from disgusting things. You open up your fridge, there's a bad smell in it. You don't say, oh, that's great. But like a lot of things, it gets more complicated. Jonathan Haidt points out that if you say to somebody, do you want to see something disgusting? They'll almost always say, yeah, have a look.
There are websites dedicated to this, unfortunately.
Yes. And I think, I wrote a book on this called The Sweet Spot, about a sort of paradoxical reaction that sometimes things that frighten us could be fun, like a haunted house or a scary movie. Things that disgust us, things that even sadden us, if we have the right distance from them and we feel we're safe, could be an opportunity for exploration and an opportunity for some sort of enjoyment.
Right. So yeah, it's more complicated, and anybody who tries to come up with some grand theory of these is going to run into so many exceptions that it doesn't seem worth it.
That's right.
So let's take a step back and talk about how you open this chapter in your book. You talk about a study done in 1937 by Thorndike.
Yeah, I actually forget how I encountered it. I remember, I think the philosopher Michael Sandel gave it as an example at one point.
I just assume you read journal articles from the 30s.
Since I've read all the modern ones, I'm now going back in time. So first thing Thorndike was, if you ever see a picture of him, he is like, the man, the hat and the facial hair and the seriousness and the suit. He was also a noted behaviorist, arguing for the view that ultimately we shouldn't be thinking about mental states, but just behaviors, the view that then Skinner, brought into the modern times. But he wrote this article that is neither serious nor behaviorist nor disciplined. It's just crazy. And it's so much fun. His article is called Valuations of Certain Pains, Deprivations, and Frustrations. And he just made a long list of unpleasant activities and experiences and asked people how much money he would have to pay them to do it. So I'll read you out some of them, and I'll tell you the sum of money translated into modern American dollars. Spit on a crucifix, $300. Lose all hope of life after death, $4,500. Choke a stray cat to death, $10,000. Have to live the rest of your life on a farm in Kansas, 10 miles from any town, $1 million. Have one ear cut off, no sum. Eat a quarter pound of human flesh, and then the fact that you do so is going to appear on the front page of all the New York newspapers. No sum. And it goes on and on and on. And what I like about this is these are just cool answers, and they're fun answers, but they tell us what we want. So the fact about the New York Times and the New York newspapers says we really care about our reputations. He has another question where he asks about doing it in private, and I forget the number, but it's a lot less. People will take money for it. But to be shown as a cannibal to the world, there's no money in the world that could do it. People say that we're naturally cruel and only care about ourselves. Yet people will actually need more money to choke a stray cat to death, $10,000, than have an upper front tooth pulled out, $5,000.
It's very weird because I choke stray cats for free.
Yes. It's not how much money you would have to pay to get to choke a stray cat. People's mileage may differ.
It's interesting. These are answers from the 1930s. So there's something about the way that religion exists in modern society makes me think that spit on a crucifix is not going to be so aversive to many people. But there's some of these things which resonate with me.
Or if they don't resonate in particular, it's the ideas. So one of the items is, this isn't in my book, is walk down the streets of New York in the middle of the day without wearing a hat. And people said, are you kidding me? How much money? I need a lot of money to do that. I look like an idiot. So plainly, the customs don't exist anymore, but fine. Walk down the streets of New York in your underwear. Well, you know, that looks like to be humiliating. It's always reputation that matters and modesty and status. It just reflects in different ways as customs change. And you're right. You find things like people don't like being mutilated, which makes sense. They don't want to have their they don't want to lose their sense of hearing or sense of smell. But you also see in this list that we care about our dignity and reputations. We care about having a diversity of experiences. We care about respect for those who love you. Have to pay people a lot of money to spit on a picture of their mother.
There's an award given out in my department honoring this psychologist, and he was a war veteran. And they bring out his uniform and they put it in the room. And I remember a student asking me, how much money would it take for you to go and put on that uniform? It's not that you can't pay me billions to do it. It's like, it's such an aversive thought. I don't know why you're asking me the question.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's actually something very interesting about our moral psychologies, which is they're actually not utilitarian calculations. Some of the questions are offensive.
Right.
There is a certain amount of money I would probably take to spit on a picture of my mother. You know, I could use the money to do good things, but I'd be really mad at somebody who asked me that.
I sometimes wonder why the desire to boil everything down to any specific singular source of motivation. And I guess we have a desire for elegance, but you got to go to great lengths to try to unify some of these things.
That's right. I appreciate desire for elegance. I think to some extent is often also a desire to avoid proposing too much mental machinery. This sort of plurality theory, which I think is right, suggests that we have different mental machinery for hunger and for thirst and for reputation and avoiding pain and so on. And it's a long list and leads to a complicated mind. And some people don't want to propose a complicated mind. And maybe all things being equal, if they could explain just as much in a simpler way, we should favor their theory. There's something to parsimony and simplicity. But I don't even think they get off the ground. I think it's very hard to explain human motivation without saying, you know, we're the kind of people who get hungry. If you don't get food in your system, it gets increasingly unpleasant, an increasing desire for hunger. We're also the kind of creature that cares a lot what other people think about us. And a social death, cancellation or whatever, I think many people would prefer to be physically maimed than have their reputation besmirched to the world. And those are just separate facts about minds that can't be reduced to one single principle.
If human life consists of a mind and a body that had to adapt to its environment, physical and social, you would, I think, have to propose some view of how all of the things that it had to adapt to were unified.
I think that's right. And I think you could also turn this around, which this is the chapter where I talk about evolution throughout the book, because the fact that the mind evolved and is a biological thing and it evolved is important for understanding a lot of things. You can't really think about perception or memory, for instance, without asking, what are these things for? What are they adapted for? But it is really the case when it comes to our appetites, our motivation, what impels us. So if you think about what we want, Thorndike's list, any list, James's list, it turns out to only make sense from the standpoint that we're creatures that evolve through natural selection. We want to eat things like plants and meats and sugar. We don't, as a rule, want to eat rocks. Well, why not? Don't say, you know, people shouldn't say, well, it's obvious, but why not? Well, there's a good answer, which is the former give you nutrients that make you live. If you only wanted to eat rocks and you didn't care about other things, you'd be dead and you wouldn't reproduce. We like, for the most part, to have sex with people. If there was ever a mutant who just preferred to have sex with trees, then the genes from that mutant wouldn't survive, and so on and so forth. These are sort of dumb, meant to be dumb and obvious cases. But I think even the more subtle cases, like caring about our reputation, matters a lot once you realize what a social creature we are and how dependent we are on the goodwill of others.
And this is, again, not to say that there isn't a lot to be learned about how experience shapes the mind.
We've evolved a literal appetite for food. But if you grew up where I grew up, it could be lox and bagels. If you're from Korea, it could be kimchi. And then as an adult, you might carry those tastes for the rest of your life. And so your appetite for food will be different. There's differences due to culture. There's individual differences. There's differences of all sort. There's nothing theoretically weird in accepting both. You know, and this is true for other things. Just it's also true for language. There are universals of language, and our brains and minds have been evolved to use and learn language. But English is different from Korean, which is different from, you know, from Dutch, from whatever.
I recently came across a paper arguing that the consonant sounds that are involved in curse words across many languages are very similar. These hard consonants.
You know, a long time ago, I was interested in teaching my children new obscenities. I was interested in how you learn obscenities because obscenities are not explicitly taught by adults. So I did something where whenever like I banged my foot or something, I would scream eBay. After the famous auction site. And I was wondering whether my young boys would treat eBay as an obscenity and do it themselves, but they just found it very funny. And I may not have managed to persuade them, but now I'm wondering, based on what you told me, maybe it doesn't sound right for a
swear word. Maybe it doesn't have like enough cuz or like
enough cuz. Yeah.
Paul, I've often found it hard to determine beforehand what things I'm going to call emotions and what things I'm going to call motivations. It's sort of been a puzzle to me where we draw the line.
Yeah, and I kind of punt through the chapter. I don't define emotions in some way that distinguishes them from motivations or from psychologists now use the term affect a lot, affective states, often I think to get away from these problems. I think there's some deep issues here. I worry sometimes, though, that we're trying to take some things that are different in all sorts of ways and kind of forcibly bundle them into categories. Again, I'm defending splitting against lumping. You and I, you more than me, actually have done research on disgust. And I've read articles saying, is disgust an emotion? When the great psychologist Paul Ekman broke up and talked about basic emotions, we should say what the basic emotions are. Can you rattle them off?
So there's sadness, anger, fear, happiness, surprise, disgust, and then he added contempt later on.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And the so-called basic emotions.
Meaning universal, meaning it's you seem to see it everywhere. Most importantly for Ekman, building on Darwin, you seem to see a very, very similar kind of facial expression across cultures.
That's right. Whether or not something, so disgust has been challenged as to whether or not it's an emotion. Some things don't seem to fall into the same paradigm, maybe because of their narrowness. Certainly surprise and happiness and sadness seem to be, you know, have sort of a generality to them that other emotions don't.
Yeah, maybe what it is things like hunger, thirst, and sexual desire. There's so clearly a behavior that will minimize that state. There's a very clear pairing between feeling hunger and wanting food.
Yeah.
It's less the case maybe with an emotion that could be elicited by any number of things and could dissipate through any number of ways.
Yeah.
And disgust seems like that kind of emotion that people argue is not an emotion because it's so rigid that it often feels more like a reflex. Whereas things like happiness and sadness and fear may involve more of an appraisal about what's going on, more of a judgment about what's going on, more thought.
That's right. So you think of something like envy and, you know, It's too glib to say it's that you have a choice whether or not to feel envy, but certainly as to how you construe the situation. You know, if you didn't eat for 3 days and somebody said, well, you're choosing to be hungry, you say, no, you're not choosing to be hungry. I'm really hungry. But if I say, oh, I feel so much envy, you could say, well, stop being that way. And the way to fix it is to recognize your life is good and recognize that you shouldn't feel that way to people. So it's much more complicated.
This episode of the Psych Podcast is once again brought to you by GiveWell.org. We're proud to continue working with GiveWell because we fundamentally believe in the work that they're doing. GiveWell is an organization that is simply trying to maximize the impact of charitable donations. Because when you give to charity, it's hard to know how much impact your donation will actually have. Where do you get the information to know exactly where your dollars are going? It's difficult, if not impossible, to answer that question for most charities. GiveWell dedicates themselves to doing research to answer just this question. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have already used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. And the evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives as well as improve the lives of millions more. Importantly, GiveWell makes all of this research available for free on their website because they want as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about their charitable donations. So they publish it on their website. They give recommendations for free. You don't even have to sign up. And when they allocate your tax-deductible donation to charities or funds that you choose, they won't take a cut. So, if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. In order to do that, all you have to do to claim your match is go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Once again, that's givewell.org, pick podcast and enter psych at checkout.
So, there's a really good debate about disgust. There's several debates about disgust. And I'm curious where you stand on this, because I know you've done work on moral disgust, or so-called moral disgust, where on the one hand, a lot of evolutionary biologists think disgust is fundamentally a reaction against things that can make us sick. And under some versions of it is also against people who can make us sick, like diseased people. So there's some studies showing that plainly we're disgusted by feces and urine and rotten meat, but we're also could be disgusted by people who look incredibly sickly in some way that seems to indicate infection. So that's a sort of low-level theory. But then you get to somebody like Paul Rozin, who is a psychologist I think we both really admire and done more work on disgust than anybody else. And he says disgust is something, anything extends to anything that reminds us of our animal origins. And so you can be disgusted at body waste and all of that, because that reminds us. We could also be disgusted at really bad behavior that is in some way viewed as animalistic. And I've always been a little bit skeptical about this. I've always think like, well, an x-ray reminds me of my animal origins, but it's not disgusting. A DNA analysis isn't disgusting.
So I think there's a real question here. Somebody like Paul Rozin or John Haidt has in the past said, even though disgust originally might have evolved in order to protect us from ingesting a substance that might kill us or touching somebody who might be diseased, it's an emotion that's been exapted, co-opted basically by evolution to also make moral evaluations. And so we want to keep our bodies and souls pure, so the story goes. So we avoid impurity at the level of moral acts as well. I am with you in my skepticism, and I've argued as much. I think that there is a legitimate question as to whether disgust is a unified phenomenon. So many people, when they study disgust, tend to divide it up into sexual disgust, so disgust at incest, for instance, food disgust, disgust at things that might make you sick, including other human beings. Whether or not we have truly full-blown moral disgust is something that I don't think is the case. Now, we use the word a lot in English. We say, I'm completely disgusted by that person's immoral act.
Yeah.
I think it's purely metaphorical. And I think that for a number of reasons. But the one that really got me thinking the most was, if it's the case that the emotion of disgust is activated for immoral acts, truly, like a used car salesman. And we're talking here not an immoral act that also involves gross things, but just a purely immoral act. You would think that the same word that we use for gross things, disgust in that basic low-level sense, would be used for those immoral things in other languages as well. And that's not the case.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, there's some research done showing that there are many languages that don't use the word disgust to indicate that same kind of moral disapproval. And English just happens to. And I think that it's more of a symbolic way in which we use it. I mean, it's a very strong avoidance response. And again, to borrow this from you, you've given the example of how we use the term lust when we say I'm lusting after that new car or that new Apple computer. We all know we don't really mean it. We're not actually lusting.
Yeah.
And then I think we're not actually being disgusted. I think really it's more like a strong anger that we're feeling.
It's fairly interesting that it is a metaphor. I think you're right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a powerful metaphor because of certain features that real disgust has. So if I say, I really disagree with what you're saying, it makes me angry. It's like, okay, we have a disagreement here. But if I say, what you're saying is disgusting, I'm implying through the metaphor of disgust that it's objectively vile.
Yeah.
And you are to be yourself disgusting for generating it. So it's very powerful.
I actually come from a family with lots of strong disgust sentiments. So one of the powerful ways in which my behavior was kept in check was a look of disgust from my mother or my sister. There is nothing that says more disapproval than that wrinkling of the nose.
I like the idea of there being, I should know this, but you talk about different forms of disgust, like sexual disgust versus body disgust. If that's true, then you would expect there's all these wonderful disgust scales where you ask people how to disgust. And I've done some of my favorite items are, I remember two items. One is you have to pick up a dead cat with your hands, which for me, oh, there's not enough money in the world. But other people are okay with it. But then another one is you sit on a bus seat and it's been slightly warm from the last person. And I find that, why in the world would that bother somebody? My question is if they're separate, then you're sort of how disgusted you are by one kind of thing shouldn't really predict how disgusted you are by another.
That's right. And in fact, one of the more popular scales is called the three domain disgust scale because it separates disease kind of disgust from sex disgust, and they include a scale on moral disgust. Those things, as you might expect, are related to each other, right? As if you are more likely to say you're disgusted by one thing, you are more likely to say you're disgusted by another thing in another domain, but they separate out. And so I think the understanding there is that we share this one word for these three different domains, and maybe there's an important way in which they all correspond to the same kind of subjective feeling of being grossed out, but that it's worth it to separate them. Maybe the disgust that we have at, say, incest is different in a deep way. And by deep here, I mean the roots of that disgust might have come from a completely different mechanism than disease avoidance.
Yeah.
So there is the threat that you're going to get sick and die. Germs, pathogens have been one of the biggest threats to our life throughout human history. But the threat of having the wrong kind of sex, in this case, sex with a close relative, is very different than that.
That's really interesting. It's also a good example of how evolutionary theory informs the sort of predictions you would make. So you might think, a lot of scholars through history thought this, that we have no natural repellence towards incest. It's just that society says you shouldn't be having sex with your mother, your father, your son, your daughter, your brother, your sister. Now, first thing, anybody who ever watches teenagers in the same family or whatever thinks there really does seem to be this natural repellence. There are exceptions to everything, but brothers and sisters are not typically drawn to each other as sexual partners. They're more drawn like a sworn enemies.
True sense in which exceptions prove the rule.
Yes. And exceptions are actually, in the case of incest avoidance, the exceptions tend to be cases where the people didn't live together early on. So whatever psychological mechanisms trigger incest avoidance didn't work. So fathers do not typically have sexual feelings towards daughters that they raised. But sometimes the stepfather enters the family and the daughter's quite old. And then the simple fact that, oh, well, she's now a relative doesn't seem to necessarily shut down sexual desire.
We should spell out the threat of having sex with a close relative is that it leads to very unhealthy offspring. So it would decrease the chances that your offspring are going to survive and reproduce. And that's a good reason why we might feel disgust. But we don't know who our relatives are all the time. And so there might be cues, you know, and other animals might be able to detect who is a genetic relative through different senses. But humans, as far as I know, aren't very good at doing that.
That's right. The psychologist Deborah Lieberman and her colleagues did a great study. She asked people all sorts of questions, including, you know, how sexually attractive do you find your siblings? And, you know, how old are they? And she found that one big predictor is being raised with them as children. And there are other things. For instance, watching your own mother nurse another child for a long period might also kind of say, that's kin. I don't want to be near them. And then this shows up in this incredibly interesting natural experiment that happened many years ago in the Israeli kibbutz. The kibbutz was a socialist experiment, and in some cases, a very extreme one, where children were raised communally. And the thought had always been when they would become adults, they would marry off and they'd have kids and who would themselves be raised communally. But the finding was when they were adults, they had no interest in each other. Even though they knew intellectually that, well, you know, we had different parents, we're not really related, but it's a real libido killer being raised together. And I think that that's the evolutionary trick to keep us from mating with our close relatives. I'll also say, by the way, on your point, this is kind of a niche reference, but there's the popular TV show Game of Thrones, and the sequel, House of Dragons, has these very incestuous relationships. Because this is an HBO production, everybody looks incredibly good, and they're fit, and they're... But people have looked at this and said, you know, these unfortunate children would in real life be riddled with terrible diseases and have terrible infirmities.
There are some cultures that highly value cousin marriage.
Yes.
Presumably what goes on there is that in these cultures, you have many cousins. You're not going to be raised around them as if they were siblings, for one. And for two, cousin marriage turns out not to be that genetically dangerous.
That's right.
Sibling sex is much more dangerous. But yeah, you've described the Westermarck hypothesis, as it's called, about being raised around somebody who's very close to you makes you sort of turn off that sexual mechanism. I was talking to Deb Lieberman once, and she mentioned an interesting sex difference. And she said, while if you ask the young men and women who were raised with each other, how disgusted would you be at the thought of having sex with this person of the opposite sex that you were raised with? The women said, it's disgusting, absolutely not, never. The boys said, that's disgusting, absolutely not, never. Why did she say something? I don't know if she ever reported that.
So this is probably the most unfortunate way of getting into the topic of sex differences. But there are sex differences. So there's all sorts of claims that, women gossip more than men, or men do this better than women. And often these are subtle, tiny findings that maybe are cultural specific, but there are big ones. And the big ones are in the domain we're talking about, involving sexual preference and sexual desire. The sort of logic of natural selection for species like ours is that it behooves a man to be more promiscuous than a woman on average. A man could, in theory, have sex with 100 women and have 100 kids. If a woman mates with 100 men, she's not going to have 100 kids. She's going to have, just one. So it pushes men towards promiscuity relative to women. I'm going to qualify this in a second, but there have been huge cross-cultural studies that look at this in all sorts of ways, including the simplest way, because we're dealing with people, is just asking people, like, how many sexual partners you want in your life? How many sexual partners you want in next year? And wherever you ask, you find men want more. Sometimes it's a big difference. Sometimes it's a moderate difference. But men would always want more sexual partners. So that's there you find the universal of sexual desire showing itself everywhere you look, everywhere in the world. But then, and here's the qualification, the numbers differ radically from society to society. There are societies that are very sexually permissive, and the male numbers are high and the female numbers are high. Not as high as the males, but still high. Other cultures, they're much lower. And there are cultures where the number of partners a woman wants to have is actually higher than the number of partners a man wants to have in a different culture. So you have what a psychologist calls a main effect of sex. You also have a main effect of culture.
So let me play devil's advocate and ask, what's wrong with the explanation that the universal that you're capturing is male dominance and male desire to control female sexuality, something like patriarchy? Wouldn't that also explain these differences?
It could. And there's no culture free of patriarchy, so it's hard to tell. There's different sorts of data that chew away from this. One is the findings we have are not exclusively human. In every other species that has the same sort of size asymmetry and other dimorphism, you find a similar difference in sexual practice. And anything's possible. It's possible it's biological for 1,000 other species. And for humans, there's no biology at all. It's just a patriarchy. But it seems unparsimonious. Another fact is the same data emerges from gay men and gay women. So gay men who are attracted to men still want a lot of partners. And gay women who are attracted to women still want fewer.
Let me add something to this, because I think it's worth talking about. Inequalities might exist biologically and be magnified by culture because of that biology.
That is exactly right. And it's also a good illustration of how something that has an evolutionary origin is neither good nor inevitable. So this, say, the simplest story is for reasons that have to do with actually sexual dimorphism, men are on average a lot larger than women, a lot more aggressive. Suppose this, even in the most modern societies, means that there's male dominance. You could look at that and say, well, that's awful. You should have equality. And now we're smart enough to fix society so you get equality. One could also even argue, and some have, that a female-dominated culture would be better. Maybe because women are in some ways less aggressive, less prone to violence, and so better able to coordinate a large, peaceful society. Now, somebody could say, no, that's a horrible idea. But what they can say is, well, you don't want to go against evolution. I mean, of course you want to go against evolution. If we just lived the lives of evolution, I would already be dead. We'd have no antibiotics. We'd have no literacy. People with even minor medical problems would all be dead. You know, we're smart enough to say, well, this is how biology wired us up. Now we can do better.
Yeah, life could easily become, was it Hobbes who said, nasty, brutish, and short?
That's right. You want to see a creature left at her pure biological impulses, check out a three-year-old. You want to live like that? You know, well, not me.
Some people might ask, why do evolutionary psychologists so often focus on sex differences? To which I would say that might be a quirk of the way in which we use the term evolutionary psychology nowadays. That term, I think, properly refers to nearly any psychologist who relies at some level on an evolutionary account for explaining the existence of various features of the human mind. But recently, it's come to mean a particular kind of evolutionary psychologist, and often that means one that's focused excessively on sex differences.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to understand the evolution stuff to understand why people are attracted to studying sex differences. Most of evolution is about universals. Why we have opposable thumbs is a question that is about all human beings. There are very few hypotheses about differences that can be tested as easily as those that involve sexual selection. We can see this across all animals that rely on sexual reproduction, and it can yield some understanding about sex differences in human beings, clearly.
I think that's right. And also, evolutionary theories often make, in subtle ways, competing predictions regarding sexuality that are very interesting. I got to say, to go back to something you said before, I kind of wish they would retire the term evolutionary psychologist, because I think all psychology should be informed by evolutionary theory, and bringing it out as a sort of specialty, it's understandable, but it's a bit odd. It's like the phrase I've heard, evidence-based medicine. And I kind of say, oh my God, really? There's the other kind? So, for instance, I know quite a lot of people who do study in perception, visual perception, how we see the world, how we identify objects, and their thinking is deeply influenced by evolutionary theory. They say, well, what has perception evolved to do? What sort of creatures are we supposed to track in an environment? What sort of light sources should there be, and so on? And they're so immersed in evolutionary theory that they would never call themselves evolutionary psychologists, because it's not as if there's some different way to study the human capacity to recognize things and to see the world around us.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it maybe is a point that we made early on, which is that in some ways, this science of ours has emerged in the last century, give or take, in a way that has led to labels that may not make that much sense, divisions that may not make that much sense, and whatever has been carved out by the term evolutionary psychologists, I agree. There is no psychologist that I know who would deny the influence of evolution. Some might say it matters more or less, and some might say it matters nothing for my specific hypothesis. I simply don't deny it. But to the extent that anybody's theory of psychology would be inconsistent with evolution, then I think it would raise some red flags.
That's right. So my own personal research isn't influenced at all by neuroscience.
Right.
But I'm not a denier.
Maybe this is a nice spot to move a little bit toward the last thing that we will talk about, which is moral psychology. Breakthroughs in our understanding of human morality came directly from our understanding of human evolution.
I think that's right. I think it's not just one of the great success stories in psychology or evolutionary theory. It's one of our great intellectual success stories we've ever had, which is answering the question, why are we nice to each other? You know, taking in a broad sense, we take care of our kids, we support our friends, we fight for our country. Sometimes we're nice to strangers. And for the longest time, this was just a mystery. So either you had to say it was due to divine intervention, God made us nice, or you had to say it's entirely some sort of weird cultural thing that emerged. But if you believe in nature, if you believe in evolution, you should believe that we are truly infinitely selfish. And I think one of the great intellectual findings, again, has been over the last, say, 150 years, we've come to realize that evolutionary theory elegantly explains not everything, but elegantly explains all sorts of kindness. We love our children and support our kids because we share genes with them. And creatures that do that sort of thing survive and reproduce more than others. We are kind to our friends and we show gratitude towards them and resentment when we're cheated. This gets a lot more complicated, but because creatures like us who engage in continued interaction gain from certain interactions at a genetic level. And so we've developed not a sort of universal kindness, but a careful, conscious kindness where when somebody is kind to us and we reciprocate and they reciprocate back, we have bonds of friendship and loyalty. And this isn't magic. It comes out from sort of a cold evolutionary logic. At the same time, though, I think it's so much of what makes life worth living. It makes possible love and gratitude and kindness and affection and goodness. That's how I tell the story.
It's a beautiful story. I think we've all had to explain this, or at least argue about this with students who might immediately respond with, but you're starting with the claim that humans are nice and altruistic and kind. And then you're asking, well, how could evolution have made us this way? Doesn't it seem inconsistent? Well, my answer is, on your own telling, the reason that we love our kids is because it somehow benefits our genes. And the reason that we're kind to strangers is because it benefits us. That's not the kind of nice or altruistic that I was talking about. That's selfish.
Yeah.
Doesn't this just show that humans are deeply selfish? Not that there is some aspect of morality that needs to, that's a puzzle.
Yeah. It points to an incredibly important distinction, which William James was very good at. So let's move away from sex and morality, just take food. So he points out, you know, why do we eat? Well, there's an evolutionary answer, which is animals that ate survived and got to reproduce and so on. Animals that had no interest in eating died off. There's evolutionary theory. So then James says, if somebody asked you why you're eating that club sandwich right now and said, aren't you eating it so you will survive and spread your genes? You'd think that they were an idiot. You're eating. This is not why you're eating. You're eating because you're hungry, or you're eating because your mother made it for you and you don't want to hurt her feelings, or you're eating because it's lunchtime. There's all sorts of reasons why we eat. And the point here is the evolutionary account of why something evolved in our head is separate from the sort of motivational account. And this brings us back in a powerful way to emotions, which is it is true at the same time that the reason why we care for our kids is a sort of a cold evolutionary mechanism that extends from all manners of creature and is cold and amoral, involving the replication of genes. And we care for our kids because we love them. We, honest to God, love them. Love isn't an alternative to evolution. It's the product of it.
So what evolution did was not make organisms that would calculate who to be good to by saying, well, let me see how much of our genes overlap and then take a measurement of how nice exactly I should be. But rather, it found a very powerful shortcut, a hot shortcut, which is make people care deeply in a genuine way about their kids. I love to use the example of sexual arousal, which I think will resonate with anybody who's ever experienced it. Sex is important because people who have sex reproduce. There's no truer statement, I think, that one can make. But when you ask people, you say, well, I was turned on sexually, so I wanted to have sex, so I had sex with my partner. And you say, well, it's not because you wanted to have sex with them. It's because you wanted to have kids. Well, they would say, are you kidding? I did everything I possibly could to not have kids.
Yeah.
This is where we're actively thwarting the very purpose that we have sexual arousal to begin with in an evolutionary account. But nonetheless, one that we have no problem. We don't seem to have problem teasing apart the psychology versus the evolution of sexual arousal. We said, no, I was turned on. That's why I did it.
There's a very entertaining article that I read, a scientific article, which simply asked people to give reasons why they had sex recently. And It's true. One of the reasons is I wanted to produce a child. But this was nowhere near the first one. So it was because I wanted to feel pleasure. I wanted to end an awkward conversation. I needed to exercise. I thought it would help me go to sleep. So that's right. The evolutionary motivations and why we do things as individuals are sort of disentangled in an interesting way. And if you ever doubted that about people, certainly when mice have sex, they don't say, well, I'm going to spread my genes.
Right.
You know, we understand for every other creature that evolution wired them up to with appetites.
Yeah.
And this is true for people too.
And we have an appetite. I think this the deep insight, we have an appetite to be nice to each other.
That's right.
Doesn't mean that we're always nice to each other, but you talk about this research in your book. You look at little children, toddlers, and it's not just that they will help strangers who appear to be in need of help. It's that they like it. They seem to dig it. They seem to want to do it. So in these wonderful studies by Warnick and Tomasello, they have an adult do something clumsy, like they're trying to open a door, but their hands are full. And the toddlers are looking, and they just eagerly run up and open the door for them.
Yeah. Right?
It's they're enjoying it.
There's all of these moral motivations that come to us just as akin to hunger or lust. We want to help people. We get angry if we see people being treated unfairly or cruelly. We want to punish bad people. We feel moral emotions like gratitude when someone does us a kindness, and real resentment when someone screws us over.
Yeah.
And so you have this suite of moral emotions that exist through natural selection. And the important part, just for our point, is they're very rarely cynical.
Yeah.
I mean, people can be cynical. People can say, I'm going to help this person because I'll help this person help my reputation. People do that. But they don't always do that.
But they don't always do that, right? But the example that comes to mind is a Seinfeld reference when George Costanza is leaving a tip for somebody at a coffee shop, I think. And they don't see when he puts it in the jar. And so, of course, he really, really wanted them to see that he was tipping them, because he wants the benefits that will come from them knowing that he was a good person. So he tries to take his dollar out so he can put it back in again when they're looking. But all they see is that he took it out.
And there are people who are cynical. I end a chapter. I do think we do things that are purely self-interested reasons. And I think your anecdote about the kids is actually good evidence for this. I don't think kids are worrying about their reputation when they act. But there is a story of Richard Alexander, this evolutionary theorist, and he's having an argument with his mentor about whether or not you can act for pure moral motivations. So he says to his mentor, well, let me tell you something. I went out of my way to avoid stepping on the line of ants. Isn't that truly altruistic? And his mentor responded, it might have been until you bragged about it. What do you think? So let's end this kind of with a mystery, or at least a topic of a lot of debate. I think most people in our field appreciate the logic of kin selection. It's no longer a puzzle why we care for our family members. And the logic of what's called reciprocal altruism, which is it's no longer a puzzle why we help each other when there's mutual aid involved. But people do more. People actually give money to strangers in faraway lands where there's never going to be any reciprocation. You give money to Oxfam to worry about starvation in a distant country. We care about non-human animals. Some people don't eat meat because of the suffering that animals go through. We care about causes that we may not ourselves benefit from, and so on and so forth. What do you make of all that? How do you put that in sort of your psychological, moral psychology?
It's a good question, and it's one that I'm never quite sure about. You propose one possibility that, well, what happens is we have these basic desires to help out others that are instilled in us because of the evolutionary mechanisms of reciprocal altruism and kin selection. They manifest themselves psychologically by being impulses, ones that make us care about others. So we have empathy, sympathy, concern, compassion. And so we act on those, but we also have reason. We also have the ability to desire consistency and to say to ourselves, why should I care about my kid and not about the kids of a stranger? And so we've developed some sort of impartiality, and we can reason our way to thinking donating to Oxfam seems like the right thing to do because I have now developed some principles based on my other abilities to think and my desire to be consistent, combined with my initial impulse to care about others.
It's very gratifying to hear your view summarized better than I could have summarized it myself. So yes, that is exactly what I believe.
Well, I'm glad. Right. I also think sometimes it's less reasoned than that. Sometimes we just are moved by the thought of a stranger 1,000 miles away. And maybe that's a quirk of modern life.
Yeah.
We've been able to hear about and see people who are thousands of miles away and see them suffering. We've been able to hear personal pleas when you see a GoFundMe of somebody who you don't know, but you've sort of just heard of, and they have a GoFundMe because they are going through some very expensive medical treatments if you're in the US, for instance. And you're moved by them, and so you donate. I think, at least for me, subjectively, it's often really not about my ability to apply my reason and expand my moral circle. It's rather that my moral circle has been expanded because the triggers of empathy and compassion that would normally have only come from people in my immediate vicinity who chances are were either related to me or in my in-group of, and I was going to engage in reciprocal acts with them. But now they're triggered by somebody who's not. And the triggering was never that smart to begin with.
So in some way, it's a misfire theory.
It's a misfire theory, except for that I fully endorse this misfiring. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not right. Rejecting of the misfiring. I enjoy that I'm moved by other people.
I think you're right. I think it's impossible to deny that that sometimes happens. I guess you could imagine two separate cases, one which fits your view, one which fits my view, and they could sit alongside each other. So your view is you see a GoFundMe and you see it, somebody, the story of someone in trouble, and they're far away, but you see a picture of them, you hear a story, and parts of your mind that have evolved to deal with people close to you get activated. Maybe many people are moral vegetarians because they hear depictions or see movies of suffering animals, and it's like a suffering child, like their suffering child, and boom, it moves them. And I think those cases are well explained that way. I guess I would think there is another kind of case, the kind of person who sort of comes to it through principle and says, like, well, I want to be an effective altruist. I want to help. I want to help people. I want to make a difference. And then they go seeking out these experiences. And I think in the real world, there's probably a bit of a reinforcing cycle, which is that suppose I come to just really thinking about it, that the pain of pigs and chickens should matter. That might motivate me to see a movie or read about the pain and suffering and become acquainted with it, which would motivate me to build on my principle, say, this is a really good principle. And you get these sort of virtuous cycles where your gut feelings and your rationality work together to make us better people.
Absolutely. And this, I think, brings us nicely full circle to the beginning of the discussion, which this is an area where I think emotion and reason interact so interestingly, where you have a top-down effect when you reason your way to something and then you're moved in a different way. So you read a paper on octopuses and you realize that they are conscious. So next time you see an octopus being fried up, you are moved in a way that you weren't before. That's a top-down effect. That required some reasoning. You arrived at either a categorization or a thought or maybe something as big as a principle that led your emotional responses to shift. And sometimes you are just shown a slaughterhouse film and you've never thought about it before, and you see animals that appear to be in pain and suffering, and this might lead you to sort of reorganize your categories and say, maybe I should put cows into that category of things that ought to be protected.
One reason why I like that analysis, besides the fact that it rings true, is that it's a more positive instantiation of a negative thing we often see and we often discuss as psychologists, which is the same cycle, except the cycle makes you worse. So I see a minority group and they're not behaving well. And I get a kind of a low opinion of them. And then I start thinking about it and thinking, well, maybe they shouldn't have the same rights as other people. And I develop a kind of wicked philosophy that says that there's a hierarchy of races and so on. Motivated by that philosophy and then seek out stories that portray this ethnic group in bad ways so I can sort of reinforce it and so on and so forth. And you get deeper and deeper into hatred, letting your reason and your emotion interplaying in a way that's, instead of going up, goes down.
Right. And, you know, as social psychologists, we tend to focus on those aspects, I think justifiably so, because we want to minimize pain sometimes and hatred and bad stuff in the world. One of the reasons that I really like talking about this aspect of moral psychology, it is nice to every once in a while focus on why we're good and how we're good and reflect on the fact that we are capable of such goodness in a way that is just as hardwired as some of the more nasty things that we're capable of.
I think that's such an inspiring way to end.
Great, then let's end.
Thank you.